Happy New Year!
Indeed, it is a Happy New Year in many ways.
So, we have not been on for a while, and we had big plans to get a lot of, like...
Stop laughing, what are you laughing about?
Upfront work done on the podcast, including changing our hardware setup, getting it all a lot of stuff changed. And doing a lot of like writing and outlining and prep for topics.
Right.
And
yeah, not so much.
Yeah, I did get a lot of stuff, like technical stuff going along behind the scenes. So
it's not a total bust, but
yeah, this is, you know, at least.
But I am slightly embarrassed, you know.
Yeah, like not getting more writing done.
Yeah, it's really kind of sad.
Yeah.
I'm not in a good position to. I haven't been in a good position to do writing for like 15, 20 years.
It's just sort of called your life.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, and people keep like, "Oh, could you write for us?" I'm like, "Oh, I'd like to." You know, but whatever.
I can sit down and write on a laptop at our kitchen table, and I do sometimes. But I can kind of tune out the normal sounds of our household, six young children.
Yes.
But the only way I can do that, even for an hour, is because you're running interference.
Yes.
Right.
Right. So, you know, that's really the only way I could do it is if you ran interference.
If I run interference. But as far as the baby goes, sometimes there's no substitute.
So there is that.
I mean, I can play with her for a while, but if she gets really upset or hungry, I can't substitute for mommy.
No, you can't.
Nobody can.
Although, you know what? She's going to be a year old.
She is.
In like 3 days.
Yeah, this is actually very exciting. So our little girl, who had a serious congenital heart defect.
Yep.
And had to have open heart surgery.
It's facing down her first birthday here.
And she's really doing well.
Yes, she is.
She's cruising.
Cruising, crawling.
Babbling,
giggling, and very social.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So
and social in the way where she has personal relationships and is wary of strangers.
Yeah,
has to get to know you first.
So, but no, it's really encouraging to see how well she's done. Mm-hmm. We were obviously very concerned about her.
Yeah, I was just reflecting with Veronica today that a year ago today.
Yeah,
52 Sundays ago.
Yeah,
we drove down to St. Francis for me to give a talk, and I was hugely pregnant with Eleanor.
Yeah.
We picked up Alice at the train station in Flint on the way home.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And then, like, the next day, I went to see Dr. Fleming, and he's like, I think we have to admit you.
Yeah, yeah.
So she was born on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that was a year ago today.
He had to admit you because she wasn't growing sufficiently.
Yeah,
she didn't seem to be continuing to
grow.
To grow the way she was supposed to in the mm-hmm. last trimester. And she was small.
She was tiny.
Yeah. Not, you know, 2 months premature tiny, but quite small.
Quite small,
in what was a percentile? Like,
was she even on the charts as a...
It's like first or something.
In the first or second percentile.
Yeah.
She weighed 4 pounds, 5 ounces.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
She was barely big enough for them to allow us to take her home.
Yeah, but you know, she was gaining and maintaining weight.
She was.
Yeah, she was doing well in some ways right out of the gate. Yeah.
Yeah, so we're very grateful for that. So we had a low-key Christmas.
The best kind.
Which was nice because we had kind of a big, boisterous
Thanksgiving
with...
guests for a week. Guests coming and going for like a week.
Yeah, and that was very nice. Thanksgiving was great, but we were ready for a little bit of a lower key holiday for Christmas, and got one.
And we got one.
It was beautiful. We don't do a lot of gifts.
No, we don't. It's some people find that offensive, but it's we don't even do like the four things. What's that four things called? It's like something to read, something to wear.
Oh yeah,
We don't even do that. We like have a stocking.
Yeah,
we do St. Nicholas Day. We celebrate the Saint feast days, you know.
Yeah, we have really, and we actually, as the kids get older and we go along in our marriage here, we've continued to de-emphasize Christmas like more every year.
Yeah. I mean, and de-emphasize like the sort of
the
secular,
the gifting.
Secular commercial business. Yeah, the gifting and the thinging.
The shopping and the obsessing about new toys and all that.
And even like obsessing about your home.
Right.
That people that kind of, but we've got to get the
right
stockings hung by the chimney with care.
So actually we spent more on some nice meals over Christmas.
We had some great meals.
Yeah, than we did on gifts.
Mm-hmm.
So, and maybe the kids will hate us for that and want
therapy and reparations. Hard to say.
But I think when we do it with them, when we actually say this, you know, our Christmas experience is more going to be about the fact that Dad's home for a week and we're going to chill out and we're
going
to hang out together and do stuff together. We're going to cook some great meals together.
And the one thing we got them that they actually got like on New Year's or around New Year's was we got them a Lego set to build together.
That was actually, that was like on New Year's.
Right. And so they spent New Year's Day by the fire building Legos.
I did buy them a big Lego set that Target had marked way down, one set for all of them.
Yeah, for the group.
And that's actually kind of a deliberate strategy too, because I want to see them work on their interactions,
right.
You know, and it's not easy for kids of six different ages
to do anything together,
to work together on a single project.
Right.
But it really sort of forces them to you know, strategize for that. And like, okay, what can we give the four-year-old to do that he's not just going to scream and throw all the Legos on the floor?
Anywhere.
Yeah.
And let's keep the one-year-old happy and not eating the Legos, you know?
Yeah.
Just got to talk to her and chat with her and play with her, bring her back to mom,
et
cetera.
So, good holiday.
It was. It really was.
And now I'm back at work, and it's feels like a slog, I have to tell you.
Yeah.
It's the dark time of the year. We've had weird weather, snow.
Well, it's been very weird.
Warm, like, oscillating cold, between warm, like cold.
And like bitterly cold.
Yeah.
And then when it's warm again, now I know for folks that aren't in the area, warm for us after -5 degrees is like 30.
Yeah.
And I didn't even wear a coat today.
Yesterday it was in the low 40s.
Yeah. And that does not prompt me to wear a coat,
honestly. No.
After it's been 10 degrees.
It feels like you could have shorts on, God's sake.
It really does.
Yeah. So we did get out for a walk. You want to talk about the walk of the week?
Yeah, let's talk about the walk of the week.
So this is a walk we've done before.
This is Marshview Meadows, but it's marvelous in the snow. Has it been snow-covered before?
I think I remember
dusting once. But
yeah. It's been like 6 weeks since we've been out.
It's been a long time since you had
a good walk.
Yeah,
it's
been
very
cold for a while.
Yeah, and then like the last one we did was so bitter cold that it was pretty cut short and the kids were really unhappy.
Miserable and, you know, kind of angry.
Yeah.
But this was really lovely. And even like, you know, little four-year-old guy who's a bit capricious in ways that four-year-olds are, he seemed to have a good time. And went down for a great nap afterwards.
Yeah. But with him, the mood he was in, kind of exhausted and cranky, it was all we could do to get a one-hour walk in. And that's, for me, physically, that's just not enough.
It's barely scratching the surface.
Yeah. I'm just, like, it just gets my legs loosened up.
Well, I think, as many things are with children, it's less about
fitness.
Well, it's less about maybe your personal goals and where you are, like, and we've had a difference of opinion about this before, but like if you're playing Scrabble, you're not playing Scrabble with the kids
to win. I crush you with my 32 letter words.
Yeah, that's not actually the goal here. So in this sort of fitness thing you do with the kids, it's not about, you know, me benching all I can, you know.
No, the problem is it's the way things are kind of structured now. Where
it's
like
the only exercise we do.
Like in Saginaw for a while, I set my life up so that every morning before work, I would go out and walk for an hour or more.
Yeah, you would sometimes walk like 5-6 miles.
Yeah.
It was good, long.
And that was really helping my physical health and my mental health. And, you know.
And I know you'd like to get back to that in some respect.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's not.
The walks aren't going to be it.
Yeah, they can't be it.
No.
And it also can't be the only thing, right?
Right.
But what you can do with children is engage with them on their level, do things that they can also get something they can get something from personally.
Now, the only thing I really regret about it is that I have difficulty with is that the process of getting six kids into the car wearing shoes, socks, some kind of appropriate things on their legs, a jacket and or gloves and or a hat and or a scarf for six kids.
It's comically
on a schedule, like, you know, before the park closes, like before sundown. It's just
absurd.
It really. I mean, you think that you've developed patience?
Oh no!
Over the years, with children, but
you don't know.
They
patience.
Constantly are finding new ways to make you
new ways to teach you
to teach you.
You know, perhaps you're a reluctant student, but you will learn.
There's a character in Fraggle Rock, mm-hmm. played by Jim Henson, actually. Well, the old mystic. No, the old, like, mystic guy.
Who's that?
I don't remember the character's name. No.
Oh, I don't know who this is.
Well, he visits once in a while, and people get his advice.
Okay,
he's this sage character.
Yeah, I can't remember his name. Yeah.
And they're all acting so goofy at one point that he says something like, "You are trying my legendary patience." I feel kind of like that, you know. My patience is legendary, but you're finding new ways.
Finding new boundaries.
Right.
Yeah. Well, but the walk was good.
The walk was good.
And it was beautiful.
Yes.
I'm really impressed with this park, actually. It was kind of like a little piece of trash by the railroad, and it's been turned into a lovely, lovely nature park.
It is a lovely nature park. It's strange that you can hear the traffic so loudly from.
Well, no, like it was like this little piece of trash land. Seriously,
there's
a train tracks. There's US 12.
You can still hear the traffic.
Right. There's all this traffic around it.
Right. It would be nice if it was
quiet and serene.
If that wasn't there, but
well,
this is what happens with an urban setting like that.
Right. Well, and that's what's always been so unusual to me about County Farm. Mm-hmm. Is County Farm is really in the heart of an urban area. And once you go into the woods there, the traffic fades away.
It fades away.
It's incredibly well designed.
It does. It fades away. You switch back. You go up into like a little hill around a corner, and then it's
the traffic's
faint.
Gone.
Yeah,
right, it's very faint.
Yeah.
And I think they try to do some of that at this park because you go way down.
Right, and that actually has another function too. The parking lot is kind of on an exposed little hill.
Right.
And it's very windy there.
And very unpleasantly so, yeah.
And so you may be like freezing because of the wind.
Freezing.
And then you start on the trail, and the trail drops down like below ground level.
Right, like I want to say 10 feet.
Yeah.
It's 10 feet lower.
It could be, yeah. And so you're immediately, as soon as you get into the walk, you're cut off from the wind.
Out of the wind.
And that's very nice.
But I'm not sure why the traffic noise travels.
It's also because the leaves are down.
Oh, that's true.
So,
we've only experienced this park in fall and winter.
So it'll be, I think that'll change a bit in the spring and summer. Anyway, so.
So that was our walk. We haven't been walking and are back to it some, which I'm very grateful for. Well, we did have that one walk in Ipsy, and that wasn't 6 weeks ago. But I think we've missed many weeks.
We've missed many weeks.
Yeah, it just hasn't come together for us.
Yeah. So what else has been going on over the holidays and since we were last speaking? What jumps into your head here that we've done?
Oh gosh, I always feel like I haven't done anything. But I've been reading this book called Design It Yourself Clothes by Cal Patch. And she's a clothing designer, wrote this book. It's I think I bought it off of Google Play.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, it's an ebook.
It's an ebook, yeah. I was hoping to get
a printed copy.
Printed copy. I'm not sure I can. I can't tell.
Some authors now release books that have, there's no printed representation available.
That's so weird.
It is weird because I know I've been thinking about self-publishing some of my collections of essays, and I could do that as an ebook, but I really don't want to.
You want a physical thing.
I want a bound book.
Yeah.
Maybe nobody cares about that, but old people like me. But
us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or
not
maybe
chicken either.
Maybe I just need to make it available in multiple versions.
Something
so
like that. I think if you're doing a self-publishing thing, it's basically print on demand anyway. So,
right,
you know,
right. It can be.
Yeah, you don't have to have it like on the shelf somewhere.
The difficulty is that you can generate a basic book layout from a single file that, like, you know, the content's there.
Right.
But I'm a big fan of print as a art form. You know?
Yeah, no, I agree.
And print layout as like a very careful way to structure the contents of each page with typographic, you know, hyphens and...
Well, it's actually an interaction with the reader.
With the headings that I want and the spacing and font and layout of every page the way I want it.
Right.
And I haven't found an ideal workflow for that yet.
Yeah.
There are workflows, but I don't really want to format the thing three different times.
Yeah, that could be a pain.
I did do some writing between Christmas and New Year's.
Yeah?
So
Oh, yeah, that's right. You had your little sprint.
I sat at the kitchen table and worked for several days, pretty much several days, on an essay, which may wind up appearing in print later in the year.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes.
We'll see how it goes. I'm talking to the guy that edits a magazine.
Right.
It's about the work of Philip K. Dick. So, big surprise, Paul's talking about Phil Dick again.
Shocking.
Yeah. In particular, the book Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which was adapted into the movie Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. And I read this book when I was like 15 or 16. Mm-hmm. And this book, a flawed, very unusual, very odd novel.
Yeah. It's really peculiar.
Continues to just absolutely fascinate me. Mm-hmm.
30 odd years later.
More than 30 years after.
Yeah.
And I think it continues to fascinate a lot of people because, like, another Blade Runner movie came out recently.
Yeah,
and
like a sequel, basically.
Yeah, and it's part of what the essay is about is the vast differences between the movie version of Dick's world as expressed in the novel and the novel itself.
Right.
And,
spoilers, there are big differences.
There are big differences. So that may go into, you may see that...
in print sometime.
In print, and if it's not going to be printed in this magazine, I'll put it online. Like I'm going to get paid for it. So
it's all good. Yeah, so this book I've been reading is part of... So I think I mentioned that Joshua is hatching a plan to try and sell
world
something.
World domination.
World domination for Joshua. And sort of in that vein, I've got a lot of these sort of make-it-yourself things.
Well, he's thinking about a co-op, right? Like
he's thinking about
a
workers'
cooperative. A Mondragon-type workers' cooperative of
textile
artisanal textiles.
Yes. So I'm actually really looking forward to this website.
Cool.
But so this is my ongoing effort to support him in that. And also to support myself. And I made my first and only successful garment. Because, you know, I've quilted for a long time and enjoy sewing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't sewn much since Isaac was little. Like 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But the... thing I did with Veronica that was a lot of fun is we took a sewing class while I was pregnant with Eleanor last winter.
Mm-hmm.
And I made these pants, and I feel like a superhero when I wear these pants. It really, it's my first successful sewing project. I just love these pants. And they wore out in the thighs. And chubby girls, you know, like you get the chub rub, the thigh rub.
Let's start a fire.
A fire when you start walking. But the, and like, I'm just going to patch them because these are the best pants I've ever owned, right?
That's cool.
There's this sort of like real, something tangible in a way I can't, you can't get it from other clothes you get it from a store.
I'm kind of imagining the scene in The Incredibles where the superhero costume designer is demonstrating the new outfit, you know, lighting them on, shooting flamethrowers and missiles at the clothes.
What do you think the baby's going to be doing?
I don't know, darling.
Exactly like that, actually. But so I'm interested in making more clothes that I love as much as I love those pants. Because mm-hmm. I keep taking them out to wear before I repair them again, just damaging them more because I love them so much.
Yeah.
So this is me looking into and figuring out how to make patterns and develop actually a piece of clothing.
Cool.
And maybe shape patterns more to meet my interests. Because there's this ongoing problem with pockets in women's clothing.
So you should probably, the problem is what?
There are none.
They don't have them.
They don't have them. So
men figure, what would they carry? Women.
So
it's not like they're going to have any money or anything.
Not if we have anything to say about it. But that, so that details like that, that are important to me in an item of clothing, I want to try and engineer those into some of the things that don't have pockets in them, add them, etc. Also, I always like skirts to be longer than people ever make skirts.
Right.
Yada, yada, yada.
Modesty. Didn't that go out with the Amish? And
they're weird.
Hundreds of years ago. I don't know.
So that's my big reading recently. You know, other than that, I nurse kids and...
No, there is something we've been doing.
That's right. We've been doing a thing.
Every weekend for 3 consecutive weekends now.
Yeah.
We've been going to meet up with people in various local socialists. Organizations. Well, the first thing.
There was more than that. Yeah.
The first thing was this Ypsilanti area group.
An unconference.
So,
which is really was really the open space technology.
Mark Maynard is a blogger. A local blogger who, you know, connects with various sort of local arts and culture folks and political folks and seems to, you know, connect with a lot of people. And he organized a conference where he invited people to come and brainstorm about the future of Ypsi and what kind of organizing activities they'd like to see.
Yeah. I thought it was mostly pretty good. I found the shortness of it extremely frustrating.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know about your sessions, but as soon as we figured out what we were talking about, the session was over.
The place is the Riverside?
Riverside Art Center.
Art Center, downtown Ypsi. And there were like 4 sessions going on at once.
Yeah. I think 6.
6? Okay.
There were like 6 sessions simultaneously.
Yeah.
And then
so you had to choose like what group you wanted to...
Right. Choose one of 6 sessions in 3 blocks.
Yeah. And then I was there in part to basically throw out the podcast idea and get on some email lists and chat with people and look for people who might want to contribute.
Collaborate
in some way. Mm-hmm. And that hasn't... I haven't seen any follow-up.
I haven't seen a lot of follow-up from that.
So I've got to have to look and see. He was going to make Google Docs and email lists and stuff. And
I think there's like 2 people that I need to email from that.
Yeah. But so it was interesting, but I don't know that it was hugely effective as far as met some great contacts, you know.
Yeah.
Or like kindred spirits who really want to work together. But we'll see. Something more might come of it. And then we've also been...
hanging out with socialists.
Hanging out with socialists. So socialists. So,
so
I have...
Why do they call it socializing with socialists?
Because that would be irritating.
All right, I'm just saying, you know.
I've been curious for a while about what is the actual DSA chapter? or what, chapters who, yeah, or groups, DSA, Democratic Socialists of America.
Right.
Around here, what are they doing? What's their ideology? What's their praxis?
Yeah.
And so we've been going to their, I was going to go before Christmas to their monthly meeting.
Right.
It's 6:30 on Thursday, like Thursday evenings. Yeah. And usually I'm barely out of work by then.
Yeah, it's a terrible time.
And trying to get downtown on a school night, you know, the traffic and parking and all. I'm not enthusiastic about it. I should go. But instead we've been going to these Sunday, like, open-ended coffee hangouts.
Right.
Which they do at, they've been, I guess, alternating between
Ypsilanti and Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
Right.
And strangely enough, both are about the same distance from our house.
Yeah.
Even though we live in an Ypsilanti mailing address.
Right.
And so we've met a few folks and hung out and chat.
Yeah.
And today's chat I thought was especially productive because we actually did exchange email and phone with a couple guys.
Yeah. And they seemed fun.
Yeah. We had a long... We stayed really late after the rest of the folks had left.
Right.
And it was just like, these were like the Uber nerds.
The Uber nerds.
Who wanted to talk Marx and
Marx theory.
Economic theory. And like, right. So, and we were down for that because it also turned into a debate about free will.
Free will and the meaning of life.
it was
frustrating and delightful.
It was frustrating and delightful, which is, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we met some folks. So we may be having folks on the podcast via Skype or in the studio. So
that's the plan.
We'll see how that goes. But that's been promising. It seemed a little unpromising. People are very friendly, but you realize, you know, you're just like, you're not really clicking with them, you know.
Yeah, polite, friendly.
Yeah. So, but we'll see. Looking for people in the area who are both kind of kindred spirits and actually doing stuff.
Yeah.
Right. So.
The finding both of those is hard.
Right.
And I would like to do more. The ASP doesn't have a chapter here.
Who is the ASP?
The American Solidarity Party.
Oh, American Solidarity Party.
We don't actually have a chapter. And I'm kind of the person to organize
You're the
that.
Chapter.
Yeah. Well, and there are lots of other folks in Michigan. Actually.
Yeah, but it's a big state.
It's a big state. And I don't know that anyone's organized into a chapter, like a formal chapter with meetings and stuff here. So I'd like to do more of that, but I also don't want to burn myself out.
Yeah, well, it has to be stuff we can fit into our schedule and work around kids, you know?
Yeah, it's one of those things. So,
and
you know,
so we can't really be going to march and get ourselves arrested and chaining ourselves to things and all that. But
which I'm to some extent dubious about.
The effectiveness of that?
To some extent.
I think you're kind of done with that phase of your activism.
Well, I don't know if it's like, I don't want to call it a phase exactly, right?
Okay.
But I just wonder, like I certainly don't dismiss or disparage like the plowshares actions.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are valuable, and I think people should do more of those.
Yeah.
I think crossing the line, the School of Americas is valuable, right?
Yeah.
Some of these things that I think are, that don't have sort of a, at least any structure that someone's communicating to me, or like, you know, what someone's doing something.
Right.
Where there's, here's the goal, and the goal is to go to court. So you can enter certain things and the record,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So I'm not clear that that's the goal. People, like all these folks that ended up getting their charges dropped for protesting at the inauguration last year.
Trump's inauguration.
Right.
They had to go through hell to...
They really did. And and it's not clear to me that getting arrested was their goal.
No.
Right?
No.
It's something that happened and is sort of just another data point in the fascist state that we live in.
Right, right.
But I don't understand that that's actually was their goal, met a need, and advanced some cause and agenda.
Yeah.
Other than providing more data about the fascist state that we live in.
That they'll...
I hope
That they'll finger bang you all wearing the same dirty glove.
Right. That the state will do that to you.
Right.
And like not blink an eye or be held accountable in any way. I actually already have that information. I don't need more of it.
Right. Right. Personally.
Personally, I'm
to
good.
To experience it firsthand. Yeah,
I'm good. So I would certainly like to see risk-taking activism and plowshares and direct actions that advance a cause and a purpose.
I think it's also a little easier to do that if you have confidence that an officer won't just kill you.
Yes, that's true too.
Yeah.
That's true too. Or even if you're confident the officer might.
Right.
And I guess what I'm getting at is I don't quite want to go down this. Well, back in my day, when we did activism, it was real. I'm not quite going there.
They set the dogs on us and brought out the fire hoses.
But I think people don't fully grasp the deep training that people went through to do their nonviolent activism in the civil rights movement. That you knew the dogs were coming and you knew the hoses were coming.
Rosa Parks was not a spontaneous
act. No, that was not an act. Right. It was not a spontaneous highly choreographed act of
Civil disobedience. It was a planned, you know,
planned and wanted arrest. Right. It was all part of the plan.
Right.
And
she was not just a tired seamstress or whatever the
mythology says.
Right.
And we can have a long conversation about how that's not fair to all the people that came before her and did have these spontaneous protests.
Right.
And get arrested for it. But then she instead became the poster child because she was palatable.
Yes.
That's a different conversation. An irrelevant conversation.
Yeah.
But I think the big issue for me is that we advance in some way in a movement by understanding what we're doing and doing it for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Rather than, I don't know, showing up to shout in the streets.
Yeah. So one of the guys we spoke to today, I mean, I've had this issue going back and forth about how, I don't know, like, do I really agree with everything this group stands for and is doing? Do I want to join them? Am I a joiner?
I don't know.
Do I want to belong to any club that would have me as a member?
Probably not.
And he said, you know, he was saying, don't worry about this, you know, join a group. We have this tendency to think, I thought this was a great comment.
That was really good, yeah.
We have this tendency to think of groups in an authoritarian way, where by joining the group, you're ceding your own autonomy to some example and agreeing to do what they tell you and agreeing to follow their values or not. Right. But it can also work the opposite way and should, which is not that by joining the group, you become more like them.
But by joining the group,
they become more like you. And that was encouraging. He's also interested in promoting democracy in the Democratic Party.
Whoa.
Which, I don't know, that seems like
kind of... That seems like, I don't know, that's going pretty far.
It seems like that's a lot to ask, I guess,
I suppose.
Of the Democratic Party, that they should be Democratic. But, you know,
it's
something they're clearly not doing, and many, many Democrats don't seem interested in it. I mean, just look at superdelegates to begin with. That's one issue. Right? But he's convinced that this is a useful place to put your activism. He pointed out that
there are like 15,000.
Yeah. There are lots of people who vote Democratic, but as far as the people who actually
have membership,
have, you know, are active members who join committees and work on organizing for the Democratic Party.
Just in Michigan.
Mm-hmm. 15,000.
Right. And my guess was 5,000. That's like the number of people that would show up for a thing.
5,000 people will show up for a convention.
Like a statewide convention, just looking at $5,000. 5,000 people.
If you think of it that way, the idea that you and your friends joining could have some measurable impact by pushing for adopting resolutions and activities, it starts to seem less crazy.
Yeah, just less absurd. You know, like, how could that happen? I think there, and this is what I didn't say at the time, that I think is... is relevant, but I don't think it negates what he's talking about or what he's trying to do. Because I think whatever it is, that just sounds contradictory. If there's something that's on you that you think would work, that you think you should do, I really want you to do that.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
I'm not a big fan of like the big marches about nothing,
yeah,
or about something, but I'm not sure what it does, right?
Yeah. We are aware of all the current events and marches have been going on. We're not going to get too deep in the weeds in any of these particular current event things, including the government shutdown today.
But if there's something that you think, you know, I can do that would work, go do that.
Go try it.
Go try it.
Sure.
And I love that this guy is trying this. Yeah. He's working on this and is pushing this button.
His take also is, you know, you don't have to not be a DSA member. You don't have to not be...
You don't have to drop these other things
you could care about. I mean, you can be... You know, it's maybe people will yell at you and people will call you out and get, you know, upset.
This is a socialist plant.
Or whatever. And this is, I mentioned that, you know, I've never been criticized so much politically by anyone, any group, any people.
Any group at all.
Until...
Dems in 2016.
Yeah. Until I was a Democrat, you know, a person... on the left, who was saying, no, I'm not going to support Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And that just made people apoplectic, my God.
Yeah, no, it was ugly.
And they're still apoplectic.
Yeah, it's still
about, ugly. You know, how the small fringe of leftists are
ruined
responsible.
Everything.
Yeah, spoiled everything.
Oh, yeah. But I guess that's a good take off of what I'm trying to say about this as a strategy. I wonder about... just how entrenched the unacknowledged leaders are, right? Or the sort of like the non-public leaders, and that's a barrier that is not really visible.
Sure,
and it's you need like 3-1
in the Democratic,
to overturn that kind of leadership.
And in the Democratic Party, what we're finding out and hearing is that it's this army of consultants, you know, army of operatives.
Well, what the consultant says, so like you can all be there and you can all say what to do, but what the consultant said
some of the people who are equal are more equal than others,
right? So
maybe all you do is beat your head against it, but as someone who's slightly inside the tent, at least maybe you find out more
or you figure out
in a better position to diagnose the problem.
Well, and also maybe you discover what the leverage points are and where you can change something
in the future. Yeah,
it's sort of this classic. Well, I'd like to change it from within, and I'm just not sold on that personally.
No.
But I don't want to discount anyone on the inside who's trying to do something good.
I guess I like to change organizations from one foot in the organization, one foot outside. And
so
people, you know. For various reasons having to do with tribalism and ownership and all that, they don't like to feel like that's happening.
No, they don't. And I don't want to just dismiss tribalism as like, oh, that's so backwards.
No,
it's a real thing.
It's how people work.
It's how people work.
Yeah.
We have lots of data on this.
Yeah.
And I think we should do less fighting with it, and we need to embrace that as reality and deal with it.
Yeah.
But understand that that's what you're running into and that it's not going to go away. And maybe there's some way to interact and engage it.
Yeah. And that class consciousness is fleeting.
Yeah.
This is this saying has just been hammered home for me over and over recently because I keep seeing it happen in other people and in my own life where everyone just basically just defaults back to the hierarchy, even if they're like... they're feeling empathy, they're feeling compassion for a little while, for a brief moment. As soon as the focus shifts, the settings change, we're back to our hierarchy and our self-protectiveness and protecting our own status as opposed to realizing that we have a status and a lot of people don't even have our status.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
So, topic.
Topic.
Yeah, that was all like just... saying hi.
That was us warming up. We haven't been on the mics for
a long time.
6 weeks.
And we've kind of missed you. But it hasn't been 6 weeks. This was like, well, okay, maybe it was 6 weeks.
Five or six.
It was middle December.
Yeah.
Okay, 5-6 weeks.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
Long time.
So we've got this topic we kind of want to revisit several times throughout the course of the year.
We'd like to make this a theme of 2018 and see if we can do multiple shows on it, maybe get people back to talk about the topic.
Engage in this topic. And the topic is economic issues for millennials.
Yeah.
There are a lot of issues.
Yep.
And a lot of nuts to be cracked wide open.
So we're gonna talk today about briefly, right? Yeah, we always say that.
You keep saying that. I don't think you guys know what brief means.
That word does not mean what I think. What do you think it means? Three articles that touch on millennial economics.
Yeah. So article number one, America Ate Its Young.
Yep.
This is.
Can you pronounce the author's name?
I'm gonna try. His name is Omer Hak. No, I can't. Is he a vampire?
This came from Medium.
Yeah.
So it's Umar or Umer, Haque, Hak or Hake.
Maybe it's Hake.
I'm not really sure. Yeah. But something
I'm not sure
like
how to pronounce his name.
Yeah, there it is.
And the title of the article, or pardon me, I should say essay. This is an essay format. How America Ate Its Young, or How a Society Destroys Its Own Future.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, are you being hyperbolic or whatever, right? And he's like, you know, in just stark terms, American youth are dying earlier than European youth. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, 5 years earlier. So that's like one thing. It's a death sentence, right?
Well, that's one of his topics here, the opening sentence. Would you say that at the outer limits, being young in America is something like a death sentence?
Right. And he says, yes, empirically it is. So let's just get that out of the way.
Empirically it is.
And
it's not just hyperbolic.
Right. But he's speaking also, not metaphorically, but in deeper terms.
Yeah.
And the quote that actually jumped at me was, death isn't just the brain shutting down, mm-hmm. a binary either or. Death, if we think about it carefully, is more the loss of human possibility, which comes in grades and stages.
Mm-hmm.
So you might say, I feel barely alive, or my mother's half there, or whatever you might say. We mean that. We mean that there's this loss.
Yeah.
Their lives aren't reaching fruition, they're diminishing, they're withering in some way.
Yeah.
And that's really happening here.
The loss of our fuller potential. So not just literally the fact that millennials are now
dying
five
younger.
Years earlier, and that trend is increasing
growing.
Year after year.
Right. But also there's this deeper death when what we're really saying when we talk about death, the loss of potential, the loss of
human potential.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's like three ways we kind of shut the coffin on our young people and then just buried them all, you know. Mm-hmm. I just buried them in a shallow grave. So the first was the wholesale deconstruction of what little retirement and pension systems America had.
Mm-hmm.
That began in the 70s and 80s. And that's nail number one.
Yep.
It goes a long way towards like saying, you know, so what do you even have to look forward to as a young person? Where are you going to end up? What
right.
are you working for
right.
towards? Number yeah. two, second nail in the coffin. A severe deficit of public goods, which means no real working health care, education, transport, finance, etc.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he uses health care as an example and its cost and how it's just increasing every year and wages have remained stagnant.
Right.
And that's one example. And I think a lot of us are familiar with that example. But it gets worse because it's not just health care. It's also your education. It's also your car or your transit system, or however you're getting around. It's also your ability to finance anything.
It's a whole.
All the basics of life. Everything.
You start to see network effects where a deficit in one area has a cascade. I mean, the infrastructure of the social safety net and the social goods, the social, you know, your public services, all of them together, they fit together. They support each other.
Right.
So you can get a bus to go to the doctor. You can, you know, to go to your job. You can, you know.
Take a train.
You can take a train. You can get support when you're short on money and your unemployment isn't going to stop. Your food benefits aren't going to stop when you need them most,
right.
you know.
And the sad truth is that America has never had working systems for the basics of life. And its leaders don't appear to be interested in building them anytime in the foreseeable future. I would also say that was never the agenda.
That was never really the agenda. The agenda that we've discussed before is under the New Deal. The idea was that the state would provide just enough to prevent people from rioting, from dying in the streets and rioting and uprising. Right.
That was only ever the point. Look at me, I haven't outlined number three. Or did I not do number three? Third nail in the coffin. This one's about us, their elders. We failed the young so badly. We'll go down in history like a dumbfounded Greek protagonist. But our greatest failure of all, not just never building working systems, it's not building working systems for the young, because we only see them as consumers, producers, employers, workers, cogs in the machine of a broken dream. We don't see them as human beings.
Yes.
And
I think that's true.
That's very true.
That's right. Expressed everywhere.
In everything
that you see, people referring to millennials as snowflakes, and or telling them to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, and
get it together,
and how
get a job, you got work to do.
In my day, we had to walk uphill both ways to the factory, or whatever.
Blah blah blah. But it's not really
unless you're old enough to remember the Great Depression, that's not true.
It's not actually true.
Yeah.
Yeah. My father died more than 10 years ago. He lived through the Great Depression.
Right.
That generation is passing away.
Yeah, and that was, that was the last time that there was this sort of mass
effort to just hold it together,
yes,
and keep on keeping on.
Yeah,
and that's really it's a fundamental problem that I come back to again and again. This failure to understand that we're talking about human beings.
Talking about human beings, human lives, and I really like how he focuses on the loss of potential, because this ideology of capitalism says, well, just get a job. Don't be too proud.
Don't be too proud to take any job.
To take any job, as if jobs were fungible.
Well, as if they're fungible, as if you can just go get one.
And as if you can just go get
one. Like, it's on the shelf, just go pick one up.
And as if, the fact that you trained your whole life and you expected your whole life and you have skills and abilities that you'd like to use.
People have been gaslighting you for decades about how you're supposed to go do this.
But it's you should be grateful. Satisfied and content and grateful to be stocking shelves, at a grocery store.
Work in retail, be working in food service.
Or a call center.
But
not acknowledge that, somewhere along the line, including the fact that you've got, enormous unpayable student loans.
Yeah.
Stuff got broken.
Yeah.
The plan fell apart. The social compact fell apart. The whole
of everything just kind of fell apart.
And you should be okay with that. Because it's all on you. It's
right.
You against capitalism.
Capitalism.
That's it. Good luck. But it would be wrong to do anything collectively.
Or about capitalism.
And that's what...
Because that would be immoral.
That's what Sartre is getting at in his essay about elections, is collective action is valuable. Elections are only so valuable, only ever so valuable. And mm-hmm. they have all these negative side effects in the way you feel like you're doing something.
Well, the way they reprogram your brain.
To feel like that's your role
is to go to the ballot box.
And that's,
that's your full role as a citizen.
That's your full role as a citizen.
Right. And it completely,
your obligation.
It just erases the public square.
Yeah.
Right. So, we've kind of, I'm going to use his last phrase here. The old must give life to the young, not take it from them, as we have done. A society can scarcely go on functioning for long any other way.
Yeah. This is, it's
as a brief aside.
It's disturbing, but
this is why I'm pro-life. But
this is what has happened.
Right.
When you look at everything through the lens, increasingly the lens of cash value.
Cash value. This is economic returns and economic pressures.
You'll sell your own kids. You'll sell everyone else's kids.
All right. For magic beans.
Yeah.
Which brings me to the next article, the 401k article. 401ks aren't magic.
Yeah, this is... So the previous one was largely... I mean, I do feel included in minor ways in this cultural shift as an employee and a parent and all this sort of, you know, our lives are a little unconventional and we're looked down on in some ways, like being irresponsible by having a large family and things like that. But
destroying the planet.
But I'm 50. I'm not a millennial and I'm a Generation Xer. I'm firmly in Generation X.
I'm in some weird phantom generation, so I'm not to discuss that.
But, I didn't face the same degree of economic pressure that millennials have, and I am reasonably well established in a career. You know, I had fits and starts along the way, and I've been unemployed a number of times, but that's where I am now. So I don't feel quite as, like, abused, exploited. I mean, we could talk about the ways I've been exploited, but... Mm-hmm. It's not the same degree.
You know? Oh, no. No, I don't think so. I really don't think so.
But this next piece, 401ks aren't magic. This is my life.
Right.
Now,
right.
It is equally applicable to millennials.
But yeah, this is really...
But it starts to... The retirement issue becomes more urgent every year.
Every year.
That you work.
So I'm laughing because, remember our stink bug friend? We have the stink bug situation here in Southeast Michigan. Yes. So we come back to the studio after an
invasive species. And they're harmless.
Stink bug on the mic. He's crawling on your headphones right now, just dropped onto your shoulder.
Thanks.
I guess he just wants to be a part of it.
He wants to be a part. I have little breadboarded circuits. They've been in my office at work. They were in my car. Like, I got in the car and I reached to put a cup in the cup holder in between the seats, and there's a stink bug sitting in the cup. I'm like, what the?
Wait, they're just everywhere? Just yeah,
they're everywhere. And then I went into my office. They have been blundering around the office.
Bloom, bloom,
but the day after I got back from New Year's, I went in, and my coworker came over, and he's like, that's a new chip on that little breadboarded circuit you've got there. And I'm like, looking at, huh? And so there's these little microchips all wired together on this breadboard, and among them was a stink bug on its back with its little legs up in the air, like, I'm volunteering, plug me in, man.
Plug me in. I can do it. They just want to be included.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand.
Don't we all?
Don't we all? I think
it's gross. They don't bite. They just blunder around, and they eat fruit, but I mean, still.
Yeah. Hey, that sounds just like me, actually. Just kind of wander around eating fruit.
I just hope you don't find me with your legs up in the air.
Put me in, coach.
All right.
No, so 401ks are not magic. And this is the main vehicle that we use to replace pensions, by the way.
Yes. Yes. So like defined benefit pensions.
Yeah, we don't do that anymore. Now we have 401ks, and you can, it's like a freedom thing.
Right. That was how it sold. This is a thing that I can't convince people of. All these Republican ideologies, these things they promote, you got to look at who they benefit and figure this out. I mean, it seems like such a basic thing that everyone should understand this by now. But it's like, these aren't God-given Ten Commandments.
Fundamental truths. They're actually just lies about how they're going to steal your money.
Yeah. God loves you and has a glorious plan to steal all your money and give it to Wall Street.
Won't that be great?
Yes.
So,
That's what capitalism's become. It's become a religion.
And it's kind of absurd. So this one about how they're not magic is there's this talk about, let's say, bootstrap pulling personal finance advice.
Yes.
And the idea is that all poor people really need to do in order to turn around their lives is be responsible with their money.
Yep.
Be thrifty, save, invest responsibly. And... just to be clear, I'm not saying you shouldn't be thrifty or save. Or try to be frugal.
We have tried many times to do things like, you know what, we're just going to have whatever extra money we have, we're going to try and have it on experiences, spend it on experiences that the kids will remember
instead of stuff.
Older age instead of right. stuff.
So no, and I really embrace the frugality thing and yeah. the minimalism. There. I'm not trying to poo-poo that.
We right? say as we're surrounded by trappings of upper stuff. Middle class.
You know, actually, this is what we have left of the trappings yeah. of middle class life. A right. lot of it we've tried to ditch.
Right.
So I'm not exactly trying to just say that that's a bad idea.
Yeah.
But the reality is it takes
people of middle class income to have hobbies.
To have hobbies.
To do projects other than at a level of survival.
You right. know? And this is the point we're getting at here in this article, is that to be thrifty, to save, and to invest responsibly, you actually need enough money to do that.
Yes.
Like, there's a certain amount of money below which that doesn't even make sense.
There's a certain income for every family or person below which any kind of economic security is illusory. Because right. the slightest shock to the system, the slightest unplanned expense, the slightest anything can get you evicted.
Get you evicted, you lose your job.
Yeah. But
then you get evicted. I mean, it's just a cascade. Failure.
Because there's no margin for error.
Get and, up in jail.
And newsflash, yeah. personal virtue will not save you from
eviction,
all of these
job loss,
any of these errors. Jail.
Car breakdowns.
Because they're forced errors, you know.
Right, they're forced errors. And there was an article going around for a while, you know, you need 20 years without anything going wrong.
To really escape poverty and change financial levels, like right. level up to where you're actually going to be financially secure for the rest of your life. Yeah, you need 20 years. With nothing going wrong.
No one gets sick. Your car doesn't break down. I mean, like, nothing happens.
I've had 14 jobs since college.
As an example?
I've lost jobs 5-6 times.
Right.
And this is going well.
These are things going well.
These are things going well, and I'm a good, productive employee, right? I'm not a marginal person with a minimal set of skills, you know?
So, yeah. So really, it's a losing proposition no matter how you stack it.
Yes.
So all of this advice really about scrimping, saving, being thrifty ignores math, the basic math fact that no matter how much you scrimp and save and invest wisely, will not save you if you don't have enough money in the first place.
Yeah.
So if you're a low wage earner who cuts your expenses to the bone, so you can save $500 a year and then you earn 8%, you will still not go more than a year in retirement without starving to death. You're not going to get ahead doing
right.
that. And here's the, what's this study here? Okay. So the study found that, so we're going to hire these people and we're going to auto-enroll them in 401k.
In 401k plans. This is just going to be the thing we
That's
do
the
now.
Problem.
And it's we're doing them a favor.
Doing them a favor because then they'll save more money that way rather than leaving it up to them to enroll.
We're helping them with their
personal
old
responsibility.
Age.
Their old yeah. age. It's good.
It's good. It's virtuous.
Right. Look at that.
Win-win.
Win-win. Companies being virtuous. The study found that 4 years after hire, the employees who were auto-enrolled amassed an average of $3,237 more in 401k contributions than those who were left
or
to set
not,
up
not, who had to set it up themselves. Right. Who had the option, but it wasn't like just done for them.
Right. Now, that number includes employee and employer contributions, but not any market growth.
Yeah.
Or losses.
Right.
But
they don't talk about losses.
No, we never talk about losses.
Yeah,
past performances and our prediction future results.
That's in the fine print, but it should be the headline.
The headline. But the auto-enrolled employees also had an average of $1,563 more in consumer and auto debt
yep.
than those who were hired before auto-enrollment.
Yep.
When mortgage debt is factored in, the picture becomes even more complicated. The auto-enrolled employees owed $4,131 more on average on their homes than their colleagues who were hired before auto-enrollment.
Mm-hmm.
So the debt more than offsets the extra $3,273 the auto-enrolled employees had. So yeah. auto-enrolling actually just took away their money and they had to replace it with debt.
Yes. And
the debt is going to cost
because,
them more than
because
they're
going to
earn.
The interest rate on debt, I mean, to break it down just a little, because the interest rate on most debt that an average consumer has access to is far higher than the rate of return against a 401k. But even if they were, let's say, even if they were the same, right, it would be, it'd be basically breaking even by having debt, right? And the way compound interest works, even if the debt was, you know, a fraction of the, like the interest rate of your debt was a fraction of the rate of return of the 401k,
right,
because of the way compound interest works, you're totally killing a huge, if you draw it out as a curve, you're killing a huge area, you know, a huge volume of money.
It's just going away. It's evaporating. Yeah. Right. So in short, so you found
same thing the way a load, you know, the difference between your load, like, oh, 1% load on your fund doesn't sound like much. It's huge over 25 years.
Right. And
or more.
You don't quite see it. You just
no.
You just never have it.
No, even the difference of 0.25% can be huge.
Right. So while these people put away more for retirement, those savings were more than canceled out by increased debt. So you can't force people to save money they don't have enough money to begin with.
Yep.
Or you can't force people to save money they don't have. And the real thing about this whole 401k thing,
the financialization of everything.
Of everything is it's a casino and the house always wins.
Yeah. It's, well, again, you're putting an individual up against capitalism.
Against capitalism. Like, here you go. Good luck.
Yeah. And a few people do well.
Right. But, no, and that's the thing. At the casino, a few people have to do well.
Right. To make it look like
maybe you could win one day.
Make it look like you could win.
So you keep coming back and, you know, playing the slots or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So someone will win.
Right.
There will be winners, but not many.
So, and I mean, I've had 403Bs and 401Ks, and I have one now. Mm-hmm. And I am putting money into it, and I'm even getting an employer match now.
Yeah.
But it's not...
I think we might have enough to take a big vacation when you retire.
It's not substantial.
No.
And last job I had at the University of Michigan, I was at that job for, I believe, 6 years. Mm-hmm. And I contributed to them 403B the whole time. And there was a big, I forget what years, but it was like 96 to 99. Right. There was a big recession going on in the markets.
Some big losses.
And so that like 7% annualized rate of return that was supposed to happen turned into a net loss.
Yeah, that didn't happen.
And, you know, since then, the trend of that money that I invested then has been upwards.
Yeah.
But you can't make up. That's the thing with compound interest over long periods of time. You can't make up
those losses.
The early loss with later gains. It doesn't work.
Right. Because it needs to be there early to make gains. Right.
And
right?
So that was a large portion of the retirement that I have. Is going to be a fraction of what it had been if those investments had returned what was expected and normal.
Right.
Meanwhile, I've had 2 or 3 other 401ks, and twice I've had to just cash out 401ks
to keep going.
Usually at the end of being unemployed for 4 or 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not, you know, that's not been helpful. And I have one now. It's an accumulating, what sounds like, you know, a reasonable amount of money. But look at where it's going to go against inflation and against...
And everything else, right? Yeah. Well, like I said, it leaves you with enough at 65 to take a nice vacation.
And then kill yourself.
Is that the plan?
That's the plan. I'm going to go to, you know, we're going to go to Iceland and Acapulco. We're going to have a lovely... dinner out together, go dancing, you know.
And then honeymoon.
We're going to finally have our honeymoon.
That'd be good.
And then I'm just going to shoot myself in the head.
That sounds horrible. What are you talking about?
And then you can cash out the life insurance.
No, see, if you say that now, we can never do that. So, thanks a lot,
folks,
Paul.
This is not actually my plan. I'm just saying.
Like, what else do people left with, right?
Literally, like, it's not actually my plan. But I remember this planning session with this financial guy that sold us our previous life insurance policy,
right,
where we were trying to plot out, okay, so what does your retirement look like? And we plotted out a couple graphs for, you know, like what it was going to look like if we put so much in a month.
And it was just
Absurd. Was grim.
It was, yeah.
The thing is, it was grim even with the optimistic 7%.
The most optimistic return, settings were grim.
It was still grim.
Right. And that was 10
and
years
so
ago.
And so what we did is like, or well, 12. And I had said, yeah, let's. I'm going to plan to die at 95. Right.
How about that?
So we did this all. And I was like, well, you're going to be living on, you know, next to nothing from, you know, between the ages of, I don't know, 70 and 95. And by the time you're 95, you'll be scraping gum off the sidewalk or something.
I don't know.
It's like, well, why don't, you know, to make these numbers work, why don't we just assume you're going to die at 75 instead? Like, okay, fine. Oh, look.
Look, it all works. And you have to work till you're 70. So the numbers don't work.
The numbers don't work. And the whole thing with, they don't work for various reasons. But this specific article was that this article links to a study. The whole point is that auto enrolling people helps, but it doesn't help actually with their money situation, which is they're not earning enough.
Full stop. That's it. That's
and
the problem.
They're not really earning enough to do the kind of retirement savings that's going to help them. They're losing money because their debts are outstripping their retirement savings.
Precisely. But even if, let's say, everyone was making a reasonable salary. Okay?
Sure.
I'm thinking of my, and this is my friend was a boomer.
Yeah.
Well, he's a boomer. She's still alive. She worked as a psychotherapist for about 30 years, retired like in 2007, and all
diligently
her,
put money into the
401k,
system.
Put in the system 401k for decades, and then a year after she retired, everything blew up in the 2008 recession,
mm-hmm.
and so what she was like going to live on like $50,000 a year or something, and after so everything
it's modest depending on where you live.
Right. And she, you know, her house was paid off.
Yeah. If your house paid off, that's quite a decent income,
right.
depending on where you live.
Done the planning, right? So her house is paid off, all this.
If you have health insurance.
Right. Yeah. Right. And she didn't have health insurance. She's going to have to buy health insurance, et cetera.
Oh, yeah. Trying to buy health insurance.
Bless
for yourself
right.
in your old age. Yeah,
right. So
good luck with that.
Got Medicare yeah. and was going to try and purchase other like complimentary insurance, all these other things, right?
Because Medicare will take your house.
Yeah, that's the thing. Medicare takes your house. Right. After you're dead, though, you're not using your house anymore. They just take it.
Yeah.
So is that going to be a problem? All of her gains evaporated in 2008 crash.
Yep.
So now she's got like $15,000 a year to live on.
Yep.
So a year after her retirement, she went and got a real estate license and started selling houses so she could stay in hers.
Yeah. And she's fortunate because she's got skills.
And she's fortunate.
Yeah.
She was lucky. And that this is so.
No.
This whole plan.
Well, you saw this happen with pensions too, legally, where pension funds were raided by companies like of the type that Bain Capital used to eviscerate and eat the pensions.
Right. Yeah. And that's, so this is, and that those were protections that were stripped from pensions, right? And protections that don't exist for 401ks, that your retirement money can evaporate even after you've earned it, even after you've put it away, you've done all the right things, and you can still be in the lurch, working at 70, 75, and you're lucky if you still can.
Yeah.
Right? There's actually a fair amount of research that says that you're really not good for the workforce after about 45.
Wait a minute, what?
And this is not to say people are
useless,
but just that the way we understand workforces, right?
Yeah. No, I can be very productive. I've been actually surprised myself sometimes with how productive I can be as a software engineer at 50. Mm-hmm. But I should be mentoring people and teaching my replacements, you know.
Yeah. And there should be a mechanism for you to do that. And then, you know, what is it, what they have in Southeast Asian culture, like your third career,
Third career.
Right.
Or third,
your third life is what it's called, right? and we don't even have like a mechanism or structure for one life.
No.
but yeah, so that this is
social, really social structure.
Structure.
Yeah.
And one of these articles talks about how, you know, we really need to be talking about wealth redistribution, right? Mm-hmm. And this is the thing I can't bring it to people enough. I can't say this too many times. We already redistribute wealth.
Yeah, it just goes in one direction.
It just goes in one direction, away yeah. from most of us to a small minority of us.
Yep.
We're already redistributing wealth. It's not like some taboo that we are afraid of as a society.
Right. Right.
It's what we do, is we redistribute yeah. wealth.
Yep.
So all I'm saying is that we should redistribute the wealth in a fair way.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I mean, that's yeah. all I'm saying, you know, so that yeah. everyone has an equal, has not equality, but equity, but since everyone has equity in society.
That's a topic we should come back to in a later show, is what it means to have, this is part of the whole Red Tory thing.
Oh, yeah.
Where you,
yeah.
you it doesn't work to just give people income.
Just give them cash. Yeah.
You need to give them assets.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah, no, I want everyone to have the means of production. That's my flag.
That was another topic we were
oh, that's great.
Talking about today. Okay, there was a third
one
article.
One last article. Yeah. And this one is Fuck My Life.
FML.
That's what that stands for, right?
Yes.
Do I understand that?
Yes.
Okay. And it's why millennials are facing the scariest financial future of any generation since the Great Depression by Michael Hobbs.
Yeah.
Hobbs.
he's explaining why life is nasty, brutish, and short.
Yes, he is. This is a solid article. It's I'm going to say a monograph.
If you look at it online, monograph. It's like this. As you scroll through it, it's one of these articles where there are pictures that scroll and it just goes like it's animating stuff and it goes. It's a big like multimedia experience online.
Right.
And if you just go to print that, it says, it told me this is going to be 45 pages.
Do you want like, that?
No, I don't even have enough paper left. There is a button you can find somewhere on this page that says text only version.
Right.
That's still.
So what, 10 pages, 15 pages? So this is a monograph.
Double-sided, two pages, two up on the right. page to try and get it down. But
so I'd like folks to read this.
And yes.
I'd like, so we can like have a more interactive
colloquium.
Right, a little colloquium about this. Maybe we could invite people to Facebook in or something. I don't know.
This article really lays out a lot of the actual research, the economic details, like it says. I mean, it says it does what it says on the tin. It explains why, and he talks about the history of housing, the history of, you know, mm-hmm. all of these things that millennials are having trouble with,
right?
You know, the cost of,
right?
And why this is happening and how it's happening. So it's a good piece. I mean, but
yeah.
It's not, we're not going to go through it, you know, chapter right. by chapter today.
Well, no, I'm just going to point out this one thing
sure.
that I feel like people, I hope everyone listening knows this already, but maybe others don't, and maybe you started listening.
Yeah.
Hours of minimum wage work needed to pay for 4 years of public college.
Oh, my God.
For boomers, it was 306 hours.
Yeah.
Millennials would need to work 4,459 hours. To do yeah. the same.
I still hear people, you know, I go out to breakfast.
That's an order of magnitude, just to be clear.
Yeah. I go out to breakfast at the
Harvest
Moon Cafe up the street. Mm-hmm. And I still hear people just chatting, older people.
Right.
Older than me.
Right.
Just chatting about how, oh, I just worked minimum wage in college and I paid for everything.
Yeah.
Like, they have this idea that's possible.
Dude.
It's crazy.
How much can a banana cost? $10?
People do not understand all the ways that the economic world has changed. And it's like Utah Phillips. Utah Phillips.
Yeah.
His famous phrase is the people are, you know, the earth isn't just dying. People are killing it.
And they have addresses.
The people that are killing it have names and addresses. This stuff says, you know, the millennials aren't just failing. They're you know, the first article, they're being killed. They're being killed, right. Their life energy is being sucked out of them. The people that are doing that, the people that organize this, have names and addresses.
Right.
So this is like the theme we want to run with for a few shows, and maybe.
Oh, we want to come back to this again and again this year. I think this is the year of like figuring this out.
Figuring it out. We want to involve millennials in this discussion, and we want to talk about what radical economics looks like and what protest looks like.
Right.
For what can be done.
Yeah. So we'd like to hear from any millennials listening. If you have friends that would maybe like to call in or participate and maybe engage this conversation with us throughout the course of this year, we'd love to hear from you.
One of the things I've been putting time into down here in the basement over Christmas and New Year was setting up some extra hardware, by which I mean I go to Music Around and scrounge through their piles of dented and used stuff looking for something that might possibly work with my old computer and audio interface and all this to somehow get us good sound quality while we, for supporting like Skype calls and like a Google Hangout or something.
Right.
And we haven't quite finished testing it. I'm not positive that it'll work very well, but I'm positive I can get audio out of it and record it along with our local voice, and it'll sound basically as good as it can.
As it can.
Which
knit it together.
And Skype doesn't sound very good, I've discovered.
You know, you may be the only person that notices.
People notice.
Okay.
People complain about Skype, but Google Hangouts may be better. We'll have to experiment. So we're going to try and do some experiments.
Right.
But the upshot is, we're getting ourselves set up so that we can bring in guests remotely.
Right. And we just don't want to sit here about a couple of old people pontificating about what you need to do with your life.
No, we're not really. I mean, I want to point out the problem and talk about, you know, raise awareness of this problem. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm 50. I'm one of the vampire squids.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't intend to be, but I collect Social Security one day, I'm going to be sucking off the lifeblood of millennial labor. But we want to hear your...
We want to hear from some young people and hear their ideas. And hear what works. And we want to talk about some of these forbidden socialist ideas.
Forbidden socialist ideas and
talk about some of my...
Why are we so afraid of radical solutions?
Right. Some of my nut job alternative retirement ideas.
Nut job alternative retirement ideas, communal living ideas.
All that stuff.
Communal financial ideas, mutual aid. And basically, what did people do in the Depression that worked?
So many things. Yeah.
A lot. All of those things are ideologically, they're completely outside the Overton window between Democrat and Republican. They're completely outside that.
Completely outside.
But these were things that people did to retire.
They're more than the standard deviation away from the Overton window.
Absolutely.
Actually. Yeah.
And they're not radical. No. They're actually not radical. They're practical.
Right. Just practical, basic.
Yeah.
Getting through the winter.
Alrighty.
That's that.
I think we're going to wind up. So, yeah, I'm excited about this possibilities for 2018.
Me too.
Yeah.
All right. See you next week, guys.
Take care. Bye-bye.